Hello and welcome to Media News podcast with me, Mark Campbell. Media News aims to be an authentic voice bringing you real, truthful stories from the Middle East, with a particular focus on the Kurdish question that is often ignored, self-censored or suppressed by the mainstream media platforms. Since 2011 and the beginning of what was then known as the Syrian Revolution, coming on the tail end of the Arab Spring, the Kurds of North and East Syria began to organize and came together with other ethnic and religious communities living in the region to organize themselves according to their own needs based on a localized representative democracy, throwing off years of brutally oppressive rule by the Assad regime. Under the Assad regime, Kurds were heavily discriminated against, with many activists locked away in the darkest dungeons of Assad's torture chambers. Since the establishment of the modern state of Syria, after the Sykes-Picot Agreement of 1916, the Syrian government did not even recognize the existence of the Kurds. Their culture and language were heavily suppressed. In 1962, even 120,000 Kurds in Syria were stripped of their citizenship, leaving them stateless. After the Arab Spring, the Kurds took their chance to rise up, taking control of their areas, and began an extraordinary revolutionary experiment in radical democracy, placing women's liberation, communalism, and progressive ecological policies at the forefront of their revolution, inclusive and democratic, what is now called the Autonomous Administration of Northern East Syria, also known fondly as Rojava, is jointly run by representatives of all religious and ethnic identities in the region, and women's representation in the Autonomous Administration of Northern East Syria is mostly equal to men's. It is an ideological, progressive revolution that has inspired thousands of people around the world to travel to Northern East Syria to take part, just as progressive socialists and anarchists joined the Spanish Civil War to fight fascism, so too have internationalists taken part in the Rojava Revolution. Indeed, hundreds have given their lives for the cause. This revolutionary model of radical grassroots democracy is based upon the ideas of a democratic nation or democratic confederalism, as developed by the Kurdish imprisoned leader Abdullah Öcalan, and has inspired millions of people around the world. It built a new type of egalitarian society, a beacon of democracy and freedom in the Middle East, while at the same time fighting all kinds of threats, such as ISIS, and more recently, the Turkish state. In fact, Turkey has also been accused of being behind ISIS, using them to fight against the newly liberated Kurds of northern East Syria. And then after the Kurdish-led led defeat of ISIS, Turkey have now taken on a more direct role, organizing the Syrian opposition to fight against the Kurds, and they themselves directly shelling and striking the areas controlled by the Autonomous Administration of Northern East Syria with artillery shells and drone strikes, which have been increasingly targeting civilians, and members of the SDF being singled out for targeted extrajudicial executions. Prominent members of the Turkish government, including Turkey's President Erdogan and his defense minister, have been making repeated threats of another Turkish full-scale military invasion, despite a 2019 ceasefire agreed between Turkey and the Americans, and all of the regional actors such as the US, Russia, Iran, and the Syrian regime opposing such a move. So joining me today to talk about Turkey's recent threats is Salih Muslim, the recently re-elected co-chair of the Democratic Union Party, PYD. Salih has been one of the most prominent Kurdish spokespersons during much of the Syrian civil war and the Rojava revolution. Welcome again to Media News, Salih Muslim.
Hello, thank you for your Mark, and my regards to all your viewers and followers.
Thank you so much, Salih. So, Salih, we from the outside of Syria are seeing increasingly violent attacks, both from artillery shelling from inside Turkey and Turkish launched drone strikes on areas of North and East Syria, more often than not killing civilians. But can you please give us a picture of how you, from the autonomous administration of North and East Syria, yourself see the situation regarding the present threats and physical attacks of Turkey and their proxy armed groups inside North and East Syria. How do you see the situation right now, and how do you think it will progress?
Well, thank you, Mark, again. Actually, you have, of course, telling the story of the northeast of Syria or Rojava and even the Kurdish movement and the Turkey. I think our problem is deeper than that, because Turkey, they have a kind of Kurdophobia. So they are very sensitive of the Kurdish issue and the Kurdish people inside Turkey and outside Turkey also. But they don't clear, and still, I mean, their mentality, they don't accept any existence of the Kurdish people anywhere. So they want to destroy it. And this is a very historical, maybe since the beginning of the establishment of Turkish state till now. This is first. And secondly, the point which I would like to mention, our party, which was PYD, was established in 2003. And then we were a little bit experienced how to defend ourselves against the regime. And we were prepared ourselves. So everything, it didn't start with the Syrian revolution, I mean, in 2011. It was before. We have experience and we have our ideas how to make a model and maybe the preparing ourselves for the radical democracy. So it's our strategic goal, I mean, for this, what we are doing now. And the opportunity, as you mentioned, it came in 2011. So the Turkish state, they when they found that the Kurdish people in Rojava, in north of east of Syria, they are strong enough, and so they were able to defend themselves. And I think they directed ISIS to attack the areas in order to finish the Kurdish people. I mean, by immigrating, by killing, by slaughtering, whatever it is. And of course, we were able to defend ourselves. And then they were enforced to do themselves. I mean, at the beginning, when they started to invade Syria, it was in 2016 when they invaded Jarablus and Al-Bab till Azaz, which is north of Syria. And then it was 2018, they occupied Afrin, and then to December. So they are inside the war is not now, I mean, since 2016 till now, and the beginning, I mean. And they had very good relations with ISIS also, and still they have good relations, because all the sleeping cells of those Daesh, which they're being captured in our areas and moving around, and recently was for the Hasaka prison attacks, and so everything was, I mean, maybe prepared and even planned by the Turkey and even ISIS. They have their headquarters, I mean quarters, training places in the occupied areas in Serikani and Tel Abyad, and even in Turkey. So Turkey is involved, and mainly because, as I mentioned before, is a kind of Kurdish, Kurdish phobia, and because they didn't solve the Kurdish issue inside Turkey. So they want to, spread around to Rojava, to Bashur in north of Iraq, and so all those attacks it from that. In particularly in Rojava, of course, I mean, maybe you are following the news, maybe since 2019 till now, they never implemented the ceasefire, which was agreed with the Russians and the Americans till now. They are shelling by these drones attacks and shellings through the border, and so without make a difference between the civilians and military targets and so. Maybe recently, just a few days ago, you have heard about four children. They were, girls in that school, just near Hasaka, which is about 45 kilometers from the Turkish border. So they were killed. I mean, they killed them, and 11 were injured from those, young girls in the school. And this school is under the supervision of the United Nations, so it's not something hide or so. It's openly training those children, 14, 15, 16 years old children for the girls. So this is one. And maybe you have heard also the attacks in Tel Rifat, which four people were martyred, and seven others, they were injured. All of them are civilians in Tel Rifat, other than targeted, many places with this the Moroccan Syrian forces, commanders, and whatever it is. I mean, they don't make a difference between the civilians and the military targets. Just to destabilize the situation here and kill the people. So this is their aim. And Turkey doing it. But the problem is the other forces, maybe the Russians, the Americans, and they are informed and everything, and they are followed also. They are following. We are telling them everything. They're keeping silent, not doing anything to the Turkish occupation or the Turkish forces. And recently, you have heard about 23 or 30 parties and organizations in northeast of Syria. They send a letter to international forces, to the United Nations, either and the others, asking for a no-fly zone in northern Syria or north of Syria. So there is no reply, and nobody is caring. Maybe we can say all the world is silent about the Kurdish genocide. They want those Kurdish people to be killed. They don't make a problem for the others. So this is the situation. We are under the threats every day and trying to strengthen our situation and maybe taking our preparations against this kind of attacks. So this is the situation now.
Sally, you mentioned just at the beginning, one thing that the sort of international community do seem to care about is ISIS. And you mentioned that, of course, there was that organized attack, an attempted breakout of a prison holding ISIS prisoners in Hasaka on the 20th of January this year. And the AANES, the Autonomous Administration of Northeast Syria, internal security forces, with the help of the SDF and coalition forces, have recently, over the last week, been breaking up ISIS cells in the Al-Hol camp at the after extensive security operations. Al-Hol holds around 56,000 people detained after the defeat of ISIS, mainly women and families of the ISIS fighters, but also ISIS fighters. And of course, there are other camps as well. The camp has become lawless, ruled by ISIS militants. The Guardian reported in June that more than 100 people, mostly women, have been murdered in Al-Hol camp in 18 months, according to United Nations. During last week's security operations, weapons and documents and training facilities and hiding places for ISIS fighters were found and disrupted by the internal security forces of the AANES, with 48 ISIS suspects active in recruitment, imposing discipline and training in the camp were detained. Increased activity also of ISIS in Deir ez-Zor has been reported too. Strangely, or maybe not so coincidentally, in line with the increased threats from Turkey, ISIS clearly still represents a threat to not just the north and east of Syria, but to the world. Has there been any further discussions regarding the ISIS threat with coalition members on how any threats from Turkey will and has clearly emboldened and encouraged ISIS already? And how do you see this situation regarding the ISIS threat in relation to Turkey's threatened invasion of north and east Syria?
Actually, what I'm saying, the operation of Al-Hol camp is still going on, I mean, even today, and it will continue maybe till finish all the camp, I mean, checking all the camp. So they are still, I mean, in the middle of the operation. And the international coalition also, the coalition forces are following the operation, and they know what's going on. Before, they were not able to do such an operation in the camp, because what they were saying, well, it's a refugee camp, it's a civilian, so you shouldn't do it. But actually, it's not. I mean, all of those are families of the Daesh, and because it's not a closed camp, everybody can go in and come back. So those, NGOs, most of them, they were opposing, I mean, such operation in the camp. And maybe you have mentioned also more than 100 people, they were killed inside the camp. I mean, because the Daesh members in there, they were organizing themselves. Of course, I mean, this camp is different than the prisons, which they have Daesh, prisoners, which they are fighters, most of them. We are talking about prisoners, about 12,000 people in different prisons. So it's not the camp, it's different. So this camp is mostly for the Daesh families and so on. So they were able to organize themselves, and the operation is still going on. They have captured maybe about 100 till now, today, and they are still continuing. We don't know. Maybe they were able to find some documents, and maybe a lot of money, and a lot of telephone cells, and maybe training places, and maybe some kind of underground facilities for their court or judging that some people for killing, or so. I mean, many things, and they were not able. I mean, the security forces, they were not able to do any operation before that, because the NGOs, they were opposing that. But now they have allowed, because as we said, I mean, maybe hundreds of the people they were killed over there. And of course, I mean, those cells, I mean, even outside the camp and inside the camp, they have kind of, relations with the Turkey, because those, the operations going on in Deir ez-Zor and so on, those sleeping cells, I mean, when they captured, and maybe they were even in the televisions, they said openly, I mean, they are getting the support and their weapons and the money from those occupied areas, and they have relations with MIT, I mean, the intelligence services of Turkey. They have direct relations with them. And don't forget that two Khalifas, they were killed on the border of Turkey, I mean, in Afrin. Yeah. So this is evidence why they are over there. So still, I mean, our people, I mean, the security forces and so, they have the names of maybe tens of those which they were emirs in Daesh, and they are now in occupied areas. They have training camps, training the people and sending them to these areas. And even in the camp itself, I mean, they found some clothes of the Turkish army inside, I mean, emblems of Turkish army with some people inside the camp. So it's strange, really, I mean, all of them, I mean, when you ask them for those people, where from you are getting your support on your money and your soul, they are saying openly they are getting from Turkey. So,
Turkey.
Yeah, so still, I mean, is by Turkey. And even, I mean, you have talked about the prison attack. The prison attack was a big plan, I mean, for them, because, I mean, such attacks, I mean, done by Daesh before that time. Maybe they have done it in Kirkuk, they have done it in Mosul, in Abu Ghraib, and so they have done many operations like that. I mean, just by a number of ISIS, they attack the prison and then free them, and then weaponize them and occupy the cities. They have done it practically. They were successful what they have done before. This is first time this plan was failed. It was failed, I mean, just because our people, they were awake, and they, in time, they started to surround them in the timing for that. So they didn't get they didn't give them the opportunity to get them free and weaponize them and send them to the whole camp. I mean, to occupy the camp and so on. So. And this, the people captured and investigated, they said clearly they were trained in the Serikani areas. So they had come, they are trained by the MIT of Turkey in these camps, and they were supporting them. And people, I mean, even they were there and the telephone captured with them, they were in direct contact with some people from that area and with the Khalifa at that time. So they were taking order directly from Khalifa into Turkey or Turkish occupied areas. So you cannot, I mean, ignore the Turkish relation with the ISIS and what they are doing. And of course, I mean, maybe all the, I don't know what the people captured in Europe and other places, but I'm sure, I mean, if you investigate them very well, they have connection with the Turkey, supporting by Turkey, and maybe they have even their attacks or planned in Turkey. So because of that, I think still, I mean, the Turkish and ISIS relations is dangerous for not only for our people, but also for Europe, but for all the world. So I think all the world should be involved in this case.
So, Sally, just on a related case, which you very kindly said that you would just mention, actually on the news tonight, I watched the main news here in London, and the headline news is about this young woman called Shamima Begum, who ran away from the UK when she was 15 to join ISIS. And she has been held in detention in the autonomous administration of northeast Syria since the ISIS defeat. She has apparently reformed and turned her back on ISIS and would like to come back to the UK. However, the UK government stripped her of her UK citizenship. What do you think about this case? What do you think should happen to her?
Well, first of all, I should mention that the ISIS issue is not only, I mean, related to us or to Syria or to one country. I think it's an international case. It should be taken by the United Nations, I think. Judging them, returning them, giving them the IDTs or so, whatever. But for something, I mean, especially for those families and children, I would like to mention again and again, it's a humanitarian case. We don't want to use it as a political tool to do something, as a political object to be used, I mean, in some kinds. No, it's a humanitarian case, and we are ready to do everything from our side. And this, I mean, for lady you have talked about, I think it's nothing from our side. We cannot do anything because it's related to England. If she is staying now, yes, she is staying in the camp, and I think everything is all right from our side, but I don't know what they should do. I mean, of course, you have stripped from your nationality, so citizenship. What they should do? Maybe United Nations can decide, and some other country, the third country, can decide. If she want to keep it, of course, I mean, we cannot throw them out. And all we need, I mean, somebody to say, well, those are for my children, are my women. I won't want them to get back. So, as you know, maybe hundreds of those people, I mean, maybe from Russians, from other countries, even from Europe, from France, they just came and take their women and their children without any problem. So this case is for the ladies you have mentioned also. It should be done. But if she had a problem with England, so it's related to them. It's not from our side. But I'm sure we wouldn't make any difficulties, I mean, for this case, because, as I mentioned, it's a humanitarian case.
Exactly. So if the UK government requested to you, if they could bring her back, you would, of course, agree.
Sure. And there is a way. she can, I mean, the United United Kingdom, maybe they can call our representatives over there or anywhere and send somebody from the foreign ministry. They have done, I mean, it's very easy. It doesn't need anything. It's just a request and signing the paper that they have given to them.
Excellent.
As it was done with other countries.
Fantastic. Sally, thank you very much for answering that one. Just moving on quickly, how do you analyze Turkey's recent statements regarding this warming of relations between Bashar al-Assad and Erdogan, taking into account the protests that recently erupted in areas under the Turkish control in around Idlib? The Syrian opposition seemed to be very angry with Turkey about betraying them in their eyes. What's your thoughts about that?
Well, I think this is not the first time for Turkey to make a U-turn in their foreign relations. But it's, of course, I mean, from the beginning of Syrian conflict and supporting those with all these groups, I mean, those mercenaries and those jihadist groups, and so they are supporting from the beginning. So I think it's now it's not easy to just to get them to throw them away, because they have organized themselves very well in Idlib and other places, and even these occupied places, and so they will make a problem for Turkey. And we are talking about maybe more than 3 million refugees, I mean Syrian refugees, in Turkey. It's another problem. So Turkey cannot just, I mean, step up everything, give them away, and make a normal relations or good relations with the Syrian regime. And their aim is just to fight against the Kurdish people, the administration, democratic self-administration in our areas. So I think also maybe the Syrian regime is not so stupid, I mean, to give everything away and just to an aim to make a problem with the Kurdish people. And the Kurdish people, maybe they didn't find, I mean, this kind of killings, and so they liberated their areas from the Daesh, from the regime. I mean, they didn't have, maybe at the beginning when during the liberation they had some conflict with the Syrian regime and maybe some people they were killed, but in not this kind of killing, I mean, we are talking about more than 500,000 people, Syrians killed. So Turkey was a reason for that. I mean, Turkey supported them and they have done it. So I think the Syrian regime is not so easy, I mean, just to forget everything and go with the Turkey in good relations. And we know, I mean, maybe the side who is forcing this situation is Mr. Putin and Erdogan. I mean, maybe poor Erdogan was surrendered to Putin. I mean, when, so he telling, I mean, he will do what he has been told by Putin. And maybe the same for Assad. They can obey Putin, but they cannot ignore this situation on the ground. And all those groups, I mean, and even the, when Russia came into Syria, they supported the regime against those groups, against those jihadist groups. But their jihadist group is all over there. They are still staying in Idlib and other places. So I think the problem is not so easy for that. But in any case, we are not depending on protection. We will defend ourselves. I mean, even what we have said, we are maybe... we are defending ourselves. I mean, the self-defense people, I mean, they will defend our people. I mean, which is, I mean, it's loyal, I mean, to have, to protect ourselves. I mean, self-protection, I mean, is defending ourselves. Any attacks in our areas, we'll defend ourselves against them, whoever they can, I mean. Maybe Turkey or regime or whatsoever. So it's not so easy, I think. Maybe they are trying or making some scenarios, but on the ground, I think it's difficult to say it will be okay.
Thanks, Ali. I mean, I was going to ask this question, but you had already answered it. But I'll, you know, I was going to ask, why does Turkey want to invade the areas controlled by the Autonomous Administration of North and East Syria when the AANES clearly does not represent any threat whatsoever to Turkey? And as you mentioned, it's obviously the wider Kurdish issue that has, you know, that has was never solved right from the very beginning of the Turkish, when it was established in, you know, in 19, with the Lausanne Agreement in 1923. So Turkey have not succeeded in trying to solve the Kurdish question by military means. And political suppression in 100 years of the Turkish Republic. In fact, even from their point of view, the Kurds are arguably much stronger politically and in terms of awareness of their identity than in any point in history. So do you think that Turkey really believes that they can solve the Kurdish question simply by military means and repression alone? Or will there have to be at some point a realization that a political solution is needed? And if so, how might the conditions for that come about, in your opinion?
Well, I think what Turkey is doing, I mean, since 7 years, I mean, by these attacks in North Kurdistan, in Rojava, in South Kurdistan, I think it's a last, experiment for them to try to it's a last attempt for them to do that, because now in Turkey you can't find who are in the coalition in Turkey. AKP and the MHP and Ergenekon, all these forces they used to fight against the Kurdish people inside Turkey and outside Turkey, and they are now in the coalition. And by this war, I mean, what they are doing, maybe it's not very... told in the media, especially this war going on in South Kurdistan, using the chemical weapons and whatever it is. I think Turkish is being defeated over there. So I think this is the last chance for them. When they defeat in against the guerrillas and in Rojava, when their plans fails, it means this last coalition in Turkey, it will be collapsed. And this has opened the way about to solve the Kurdish issue, because now the Kurdish issue is very big, I mean, because it became an international issue and everybody is involved and everybody recognized that without solving the Kurdish issue in the Middle East, you cannot find a sustainable Middle East. I mean, you have to solve the Kurdish issue in Turkey, in Syria, in Iraq, in Iran, and everywhere. And the who opposing this solution is Turkey. So when the Turkish government or Turkish fascism collapse, it means the way will be open to solve the Kurdish people and Kurdish issue in the peaceful way. Not peaceful, I mean in political way instead of the war. And of course, as you mentioned, I mean the Kurdish people, they are stronger than any time before. So they are able to defend themselves. They have friends. They have diplomatic and political relations with internationally. So I think they are stronger than before. So it's easy. I mean, the strong people, they can make peace, I think, not the weak people.
Wonderful.
So I think the collapse of the fascism in Turkey will open the way for the solution, I think.
Amazing. Salim Muslim, recently elected co-chair of the Democratic Union Party, PYD. Thank you so much for joining us again on Media News to share your thoughts with us. And good luck with your work. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good luck for you too. Thank you.
Thank you, Sandy. Bye-bye. Yeah.